November 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Israel disowns a spyware company blacklisted by the U.S. for targeting government officials, journalists, and activists.
NSO is a private company. It is not a governmental project, and therefore, even if it's designated, it has nothing to do with the policies.
The Iraqi military beefs up security after the country's prime minister survives a drone assassination attempt.
Baghdad residents on Sunday criticized an apparent assassination attempt against Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi.
And Pope Francis decries the worsening humanitarian crisis in Ethiopia. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Israel's Foreign Minister Yair Lapid has distanced the government from the NSO group, a firm blacklisted this week by the United States over alleged misuse of its phone hacking spyware. An investigation by 17 media organizations published in July said NSO's Pegasus software had targeted the smartphones of journalists, rights activists, and government officials in several countries. The company sends its products abroad under licenses from Israel's Defense Ministry, which has launched its own probe of the company's practices after the alleged software misuse emerged. His comments are the first made publicly by a senior Israeli minister since the U.S. Commerce Department announced the blacklisting on Wednesday.
NSO is a private company. It is not a governmental project. And therefore, even if it's designated, it has nothing to do with the policies of the Israeli government. I don't think there's another country in the world which has such strict rules according to cyber warfare and is imposing those rules more than Israel, and we will continue to do so.
That's Israel Foreign Minister Yair Lapid. Iraqi officials say Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi escaped unharmed in an assassination attempt by an armed drone in Baghdad on Sunday. They said the incident dramatically raises tensions in the country weeks after a general election disputed by Iran-backed militia groups. Emma McCarthy of Reuters reports.
Baghdad residents on Sunday criticized an apparent assassination attempt against Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi. Officials say he escaped unharmed after armed drones targeted his residence in the Green Zone. The incident has dramatically raised tension in the country weeks after a general election disputed by Iran-backed militia groups. On Friday, there were violent clashes between government forces and supporters of the Iran-backed political parties, many of whom have armed wings, who lost dozens of seats in the October 10 poll. Abbas al-Jaburi is the head of the Rafid Center for Media.
It is the responsibility of everyone today to stand together in order to prevent inner turmoil that aims to destroy Iraq and its sovereignty. When a rocket hits the residence of the Prime Minister, this means Iraq. We should not remain silent. There must be wise men who intervene to end the consequences of this attack.
Footage from the Prime Minister's office released on Sunday showed some of the damage. A vehicle parked outside the home was seen with its windows blown out, surrounded by rubble and debris from the impact. No group immediately claimed responsibility. The United States, Saudi Arabia, and Iran condemned the attack, with the U.S. offering assistance with the investigation.
That's Emma McCarthy of Reuters. Pope Francis has decried a deteriorating humanitarian crisis in Ethiopia and is pressing for dialogue to prevail over conflict. The pontiff, in his traditional Sunday appearance to the public in St. Peter's Square, said he was following the news with, quote, worry, unquote, from the Horn of Africa, particularly from Ethiopia. He asked for prayers for the suffering population. Francis also renewed his appeal for the fraternal harmony and the peace path of dialogue may prevail. A war in Ethiopia's Tigray region has killed thousands of people and displaced millions and left many struggling with severe hunger. Pressure is mounting on Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, with 9 anti-government factions saying they are forming an alliance to take power and rebels advancing towards the capital. The U.S. is calling for an immediate ceasefire, as VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Ethiopia's year-long conflict over the Tigray region is reverberating as far as Washington. where demonstrators gathered Thursday near the U.S. Capitol to denounce what they called a genocide by the Ethiopian government and a lack of action by the United States and the United Nations to stop the fighting. Also in Washington, representatives of 9 Ethiopian rebel and opposition groups held a signing ceremony to announce they are joining forces to replace the Abiy government. For his part, Abiy says his government will prevail and has called on residents of Addis Ababa to take up arms if necessary to defend their neighborhoods. U.S. Special Envoy Jeffrey Feltman, who is in the Ethiopian capital, faces a difficult mission. Ahmed Solomon of Chatham House told VOA.
But as I understand it, he's partly there at the invitation of the Ethiopian government. So there could perhaps be an opening. There could perhaps be a scenario where there are discussions about possibility of a ceasefire, the possibility of finding a way through the country's challenges that doesn't involve the conflict spiraling and worsening as it has been doing.
The U.S. is calling on all the parties to negotiate a ceasefire and allow humanitarian assistance to reach the Ethiopian people. Makila James is a former U.S. ambassador with the U.S. Institute of Peace.
The U.S. has always been a friend of the Ethiopian people and has been a real supporter of Prime Minister Abiy. What we're seeing now threatens to undermine all of the progress and the promise of what Prime Minister Abiy came into office to do. And so we hope that this will not be squandered, will not be wasted, and that we can see ourselves all returning to a place where Ethiopia can be an exporter of peace in the region, exporter of development.
The U.S. is working with the African Union, regional allies, and the United Nations to try to create the right conditions for a ceasefire. Here again, Makila James.
So I would say that the collective approach is raising the diplomatic stakes, putting more pressure on the government, giving incentives for the parties to all come to the table, and talking across the board. This is not just a one-sided conversation. It's talking to the TPLF, talking to the Eritreans, talking to the neighbors, talking to the government of Prime Minister Abiy.
The UN Security Council is set to hold a meeting on the crisis in Ethiopia on Monday. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Travel restrictions that the U.S. put in place during the pandemic have ended after more than a year and a half. On Monday, travelers from around the world resume flights to the U.S. if they are vaccinated. Ted Knapp is a professor of economics and business at Cornell College in Mount Vernon, Iowa. VOA's Arasha Rabasadi asked him to explain what the development means.
Bhavna Patel has been a grandmother for more than a year. She lives in London, but because of travel restrictions due to the pandemic, she's never met her grandson, who lives in New York. Starting Monday, travel restrictions from Britain and several other countries end for vaccinated passengers. Patel can hardly wait.
I want to wear a badge. I'm going to see my grandson. I'm going to, you know, I want a big hat or something. I'm going to see my grandson.
Patel is just one of millions of people who were unable to travel to the U.S. for more than a year and a half. The pandemic restrictions have taken a toll on the U.S. economy in more sectors than just travel and leisure.
As people have traveled less and traveled more, it's played a big role in influencing energy prices and other prices of raw materials. And that then, of course, filters into almost every aspect of the economy.
Professor Todd Knoop says a strong tourism industry inside the U.S. has kept sectors from struggling as much as in other countries that rely heavily on foreign tourism.
Putting restrictions on the travel of human has also put restrictions on the travel in the movement of goods and services. And so in a increasingly globalized economy, at least an economy that was increasingly globalized up to 18 months ago, that has just led to a lot of, I would say, unanticipated bottlenecks.
Bottlenecks like the backup of cargo ships at the key ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles. Ships wait for days to offload their cargo at the congested ports on the West Coast where most products from China enter the U.S. Knoop says supply chain issues will likely have a bigger impact on the economy than travel as the country heads into the holiday shopping season.
A year ago, it was the travel industry that was suffering, but we had positive effects on the supply side from lower energy. Now we're kind of in the exact opposite situation where higher energy prices and supply chain issues are slowing the economy down. But on the demand side, things are strong.
Still, for travelers like Bhavna Patel, the only news that matters is her upcoming flight.
Like, if I could dance, I would dance.
On Monday, the U.S. will also open its land borders with Mexico and Canada to vaccinated travelers. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
That's VOA's Arash Arabasadi speaking with Todd Knapp, a professor of economics and business at Cornell College in Mount Vernon, Iowa. Advocates of media freedom say nations in the Southern African Development Community, or SADC, are enacting restrictive cyber laws that have a chilling effect on journalism and freedom of expression. Columbus Mahunga has more from Harare.
Advocates for media freedom say nations in the Southern Africa regional bloc SADC are enacting restrictive cyber laws that have a chilling effect on journalism and freedom of expression. Columbus Mahunga has more from Harare for VOA News. Text. In a hybrid forum on the state of internet regulations, Thabani Moyo, the director of Media Institute of Southern Africa, said his organization is worried about a trend toward less tolerance for journalists and dissent in the region. He said the trend began last year after SADC leaders' meeting, where heads of state resolved to take preemptive measures against what they called external interference, the impact of fake news and abuse of social media.
In the wake of this resolution, we have seen a dangerous consensus towards crackdown of expression online. A number of Southern African countries moved with speed to come up with what they referred to as cybersecurity laws and frameworks. To us, somewhat problematic, as the proposed pieces of legislation had serious chilling effects on expression, media freedom, and right to privacy.
The effects have been felt most visible in Tanzania, where the Uhuru newspaper was suspended in August for publishing what authorities called a false story saying President Samia Suluhu Hassan would not run for office in 2025. In September, Raja Mwema, a Swahili language weekly, was suspended for 30 days for reportedly publishing false information and deliberate incitement. Meanwhile, Zambia's government under former President Edgar Lungu used cyber laws to block social media on the pretext the opposition was committing crimes with its posts on Twitter and Facebook. SADC Secretary Elias Mupedi Magosi, in a speech read by SADC Director of Infrastructure Rosemary Mapolayo Mokwena, defended the move toward stronger internet laws.
As more people get connected to access information, it attracts more cyber criminals to our shores. SADC has already commenced the process to review and modernize the SADC cybersecurity legal, regulatory and institutional frameworks. Misinformation being spread on the safety of 5G mobile networks risks has caused a negative impact on the ICT industry.
However, Namibia's Minister of Information and Communication Technology, Pia Mushelenga, called on countries to allow free expression online.
It is thus incumbent upon all role players, development partners, civil society organizations, governments and intergovernmental organizations to reinforce cooperation among each other in order to safeguard and enhance guarantees for the full exercise of the right to information and freedom of expression both online and offline, with a particular focus on strengthening media freedom, diversity, its independence and ability, as well as transparency of digital platforms.
Zimbabwe's Information Minister Monica Mchangwa announced this week the government had set up a cyber team to monitor what people send and receive, a move that has been condemned by many rights groups. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
Nigerian journalists are raising renewed concerns about their safety. This after an Abuja newspaper reporter went missing last month and journalists were manhandled while trying to cover two major news events. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
He's always sitting in this car, watching the news. He likes news.
Tokwasi Kurun recalls her missing brother, Todwe Salem, as she stares at a picture of him in the family photo book in Abuja. Salem, who has been gone for 23 days now, is a parliamentary reporter with the Vanguard News, an independent Nigerian newspaper. Kurant says she last saw her younger brother the morning of October 13.
He was in front of the gate when I was leaving. So I just waved. Then 2 hours after, he left for work, and since then I've not seen him.
The cause of Salem's disappearance is still unclear. The Nigerian police authorities said they have interrogated 6 people he last contacted that day, but no arrest has been made and no one has claimed responsibility for his disappearance. The issue has raised worries among fellow journalists. Journalists in Nigeria have, on some occasions, been attacked or even detained as a result of their reports. No one could prove Salem's case was work-related, but this week, as the Nigerian Union of Journalists marked the global day to end impunity for crimes against journalists, they urged authorities to take urgent action on the matter. Sonny Daniel is a regional editor at Vanguard News.
We're all humans, and we feel sad. We recognize the horror, the suspense, and the anxiety. It could have happened to anybody.
This year, Nigeria ranked 120th in the World Press Freedom Index, dropping 5 spots from last year's tally. Last month, journalists covering the Nsah's memorial procession on October 20 were manhandled by security agents. Another group of journalists also were harassed and barred from entering an Abuja courtroom where the trial of separatist leader Nnamdi Kanu was held. Nigerian journalist Adefemi Akinsonya was antagonized during the SARS procession at the Lekki tollgate in Lagos State.
I just thought, had they discharged their weapon, even accidentally, would it have been worth it? Press freedom is so important. As I said, it's a hallmark of a free and just society. And that's what we all want for Nigeria, a free and just place.
Nigerian journalists say without better treatment from authorities, the country will become too risky for them to perform their jobs. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
When it comes to documenting evidence of war crimes in Syria, journalists and civilians have led the way. VOA's Siwan Kajo has more on a new film that tells their story.
Bombings, accusations of chemical weapons use, torture, killings. The UN and others accused President Bashar al-Assad of a long list of crimes in the decade that Syria has been at war. A new film, Bringing Assad to Justice, is highlighting efforts by media and private citizens to collect evidence and demand accountability for those crimes.
People need to be made aware that Syria is one of the world's biggest crime scenes, that torture is systematic, disappearances continue. Hundreds of thousands have already been victims of these notorious crimes, as well as arbitrary killing.
Syria ranks as one of the worst countries for securing justice in attacks on the media, says the Committee to Protect Journalists. Among the victims, American correspondent Marie Colvin and French photojournalist Rémi Oschlik. They were killed, and British photojournalist Paul Conroy was critically wounded when Syrian forces bombed their makeshift media center in Homs in 2012. Conroy is acutely aware of the role local media played as Syria became more dangerous.
Syria got very difficult for Western journalists to enter, you know, certainly after ISIS came up, but after Marie was killed, and that was almost a turning point where we had depended on local Syrian journalists who paid a terrible price in deaths and disappearances.
Assad denies war crimes, but in 2019, a U.S. court found the Syrian government responsible in the murder of Colvin, ordering it to pay $300 million in punitive damages. The case included evidence collected by Syrian and Western journalists. Filmmaker Tynan said much of the archival footage used in the film was produced by Conroy and citizen journalists in Syria.
These people are not just media workers. They are human rights defenders in the truest sense of that word. And without them, we would not have the evidence we have today for crimes against humanity in Syria.
As Syrians demand justice for the war's victims, the filmmakers hope their documentary and the evidence they gathered will go some way to achieving accountability. Sirwan Kejo, VOA News, Washington.
Sierra Leone President Julius Maada Bio has declared 3 days of national mourning starting Monday for victims of Sunday's oil tanker truck explosion near Freetown. This, as some aid agencies have responded to the government's call for assistance to hospitals struggling to treat dozens of critically wounded people. The World Health Organization says it is flying in more than 6 tons of drugs to be distributed to all hospitals for the victims, while the National Blood Bank has called for donations. The incident occurred when a large crowd gathered to collect fuel that was leaking from the tanker after it collided with another, triggering a huge fireball that has reportedly killed more than 100 people. I asked reporter Kevin Lewis for an update on the conditions of those in hospitals.
92 people are in hospital suffering from various degrees of burns. They have been put into 3 groups. There are those who have life-threatening burns. There are others who could be treated but not life-threatening burns. And there are others who are treated and they would probably be allowed to go. So they're in those 3 groups and they have been distributed in the 4 main hospitals in the country. The main referral hospital has the highest number of about 48 people. The doctors are coping, and the president and the vice president have visited the place and they have commended them for what they have been doing. But they have been appealing for drugs. They seem to have been running out of drugs. So far, philanthropic agencies and business houses have been pouring in, bringing in some of the much-needed drugs. And I understand that WHO, too, are flying in some of the drugs that are needed. But so far, they seem to be stable.
That's reporter Kelvin Lewis speaking with me from Freetown. The Palestinians on Sunday slammed Israel for rejecting the promised reopening of the U.S. consulate in Jerusalem, a move that will restore Washington's main diplomatic mission for the Palestinians in a contested city. Israel Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said late Saturday there was no room in Jerusalem for another American mission. The Trump administration shuttered the U.S. Jerusalem consulate, an office that for years served as the de facto embassy to the Palestinians. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken has pledged to reopen it, a move that Israel says will challenge its sovereignty over the city. The reopening could help mend U.S. ties with the Palestinians ruptured under Trump. In a statement, the Palestinian Foreign Ministry said it views the reopening of the consulate as part of the international community's commitment for ending Israel's decades-long occupation of territory the Palestinians seek for their future state. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. The quote, end of coal, unquote, is in sight, according to Britain, the host of the COP26 climate summit, after dozens of countries pledged to stop using coal and end the financing of fossil fuels. But as Henry Ridgewell reports from Glasgow summit, winning economies off coal wouldn't be easy, even for Britain itself.
Burning coal is the single biggest contributor to climate change. Over 40 countries made pledges Thursday at COP26 to phase out coal entirely by 2030 for rich countries and 2040 for poorer nations. Signatories include big coal consumers like Vietnam, Indonesia, Poland, and Ukraine. They, alongside several global banks and financial institutions, also committed to ending all investment in new coal power generation.
A commitment to end coal investment, to scale up clean power, to make a just transition and phase out coal in the 2030s in major economies and in the 2040s elsewhere.
But many of the world's biggest coal consumers, including China, the United States, Australia, and India, did not sign the deal. Emissions of CO2, meanwhile, have almost rebounded to pre-pandemic levels.
Behind this, we see a rapid rise in the emissions in China, particularly pushed by probably economic stimulus packages.
Separately, 25 countries, including the United States, also pledged to stop public financing for all overseas fossil fuel projects by the end of next year. But again, key Asian coal investors, China, Japan and South Korea, did not sign up. COP26 host Britain said the flurry of agreements shows the end of coal is in sight, but it still appears some way off. Britain itself is considering opening a new mine to produce coal for steel making. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has voiced opposition, but says it's a planning matter for local government. The local mayor supports the mine.
If we're going to have the green industrial revolution that we need in developing solar, wind, wave, and certainly here we'd love to develop more nuclear, it's all going to take significant amounts of steel.
Britain is also considering the development of a new oil field off Scotland's Shetland Islands, not far from Glasgow, host city of the climate summit. Meanwhile, the International Energy Agency said Thursday that if all the commitments made at COP26 so far were fully implemented, global warming would be limited to below 2 degrees Celsius, a significant improvement on the 2.7 degrees Celsius rise the United Nations forecasted before the summit. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Glasgow, Scotland.
A documentary about the impact of climate change in Africa is the highlight of the annual French Film Festival in Los Angeles this year. The festival, quote, City of Light, City of Angels, unquote, or COCOA, draws filmmakers from Paris and fans from Los Angeles. Mike O'Sullivan reports on the documentary, released in English as, quote, Above Water, unquote, which is causing a buzz.
A Los Angeles gathering of French actors and filmmakers, along with Americans who love international film. Among the annual French Film Festival's offerings this year, a story of survival amid climate change in the Azawakh Valley in northwestern Niger.
And the children most specifically have to do 10 kilometers back and forth several times a day to go get water for the whole village.
Taking time away from schooling. Filmed over the course of a year, the French filmmakers returned to the village 5 times.
And we're supposed to go 6 times, but then COVID hit and everything was locked down, so we had to cancel this last visit.
The film marks the directorial debut of Aïssa Maïga, a French actress who was born in Senegal. She and the filmmakers worked with the nonprofit group Aman Iman, whose name means water is life in the region's language. Chronicling the struggle to have a well dug in the village, it's a story now playing out in many other communities.
It's really about the emotion of the people there, their life, and through emotion we think we can actually access a change of awareness.
Along with raising that awareness, the filmmakers urge viewers to support the expansion of the network of village wells. The festival offers exposure and possible distribution deals for French films and television shows, which have a new audience because of streaming platforms.
Like Netflix and Amazon, of course, that they're able actually to create an audience for foreign programs. It's not only French film or European film, as you know, it's also Asian. And it's really a big change in the American culture.
As film becomes globalized, he says, it is increasingly addressing global problems. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedofo in Washington, wishing you a great day.
This is the voice of America. Washington.